The North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, took effect January 1st of 1994, creating the world's largest free trade zone. At the time, there was a great deal of debate about whether or not it would be a good thing, about its impact on the American economy and American workers. On one side, there were people who said that it would be a good thing, that it would promote trade between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. That would be good for the American economy, and people also said it would be good for American consumers because it would mean access to lower-priced goods. On the other hand, some people said, no, it would be bad for the economy because it would facilitate job loss. It would make it easier for jobs to leave the country, particularly going to Mexico. That would be bad for the American economy and bad for American workers. Now, 10 years later, the critics and supporters are still arguing whether or not it has been good or bad for America. The boosters say it has been good for the American economy, and the critics say it has been bad and has facilitated job loss. Well, this morning on the program, we'll have two views of NAFTA, one in each hour, different and opposing views. In the first part of the program here, we're talking with Mark Weisbrot. He is with an outfit in Washington, D.C. called the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He has a Ph.D. in economics from University of Michigan with a specialization in international economics and political economy. And he currently, as I said, is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. He writes a weekly column on economic and policy issues that's distributed to over 400 newspapers by Knight Ritter Tribune Media Services. He's also contributed opinion pieces to various publications, including the Washington Post, the L.A. Times, Boston Globe, the Chicago Tribune. He's also appeared on television, on CNN, on ABC, on C-SPAN, and also on public radio, Morning Edition, The Diane Rehm Show, The News Hour with Jim Lehrer, and other programs. And he's also, even before, been here on this little show. As we talk, of course, questions and comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief, just so that we can keep program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions, comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Weisbrot, hello.
Yes, hi, David.
Well, thanks for talking with us again.
Thank you.
To start out, I guess, let me ask you a very large and general question, a couple of economic questions, one that's focused on the economy generally and the other that's focused on the issue of NAFTA and workers and jobs. If we just ask straight out the question, do you think, what has been the effect of NAFTA on the economy of the United States? How do you think about a question like that?
Well, you have to remember, first of all, that NAFTA didn't, it wasn't new or different so much in its economic effects. It was a continuation of policies that began in Mexico in the early 80s, where they had there was a huge debt crisis, and so the multilateral institutions like the IMF and the World Bank imposed or helped to impose a series of changes on the Mexican economy. And the whole purpose of NAFTA was really to embody, to put those changes into an international agreement so they would be more difficult to reverse. And so this would give, the idea was that this would give investors in the United States an incentive to move production there because they would have more security and it would be more profitable for them as well. So that's what it did. So you're really looking at policies, though, however, began in the 80s. And what's the effect? I think the long-term trend of all of these policies in the United States that is encouraging U.S. corporations to move overseas and putting the U.S. labor force into more intensified competition with much lower-paid people throughout the world, not only in Mexico, has been to really massively redistribute income in the United States. So, we used to have an economy in which when the economy grew, which is normal state of affairs, and, it almost always grows for any long period of time, these gains from growth were shared across all sectors of the population. For example, in the first half of the post-World War II period from 1946 to 73, you had wage growth for the typical worker, the median wage earner, the wage went up by about 80%. Now, in the second half, or it's a little longer than half now, but from about 73 on, this stopped happening. And so in the last 30 years, wages have, the median wage has grown only by about 7% or 8%. And, you know, that's really hardly anything at all. I mean, you know, income per person increased by more than 70%. So, in other words, we've reached a state where the gains from economic growth really go only to a small segment of our society, whereas they used to go to almost everyone.
Hmm. Well, given the fact that you started out talking about the fact that the ideas of NAFTA, this was just it was an extension of policy that had already been in effect. I guess some people would say, given what we've seen with the globalization of the economy, whether the trends that you have talked about would have happened whether there had been NAFTA or not. Is NAFTA really the issue?
Well, NAFTA is an issue because it did solidify it. I mean, and it did make a difference. I mean, you've seen around the country, you know, hundreds of thousands of manufacturing job losses. A lot of those did go to Mexico. So the jobs isn't the bigger thing, though. That's why I emphasize wages, because that is the major effect, because that affects everyone. You know, people think, well, trade, you know, the idea you see in the press a lot is that, well, trade, first of all, it's inevitable, and it's a good thing. It increases efficiency, and, you know, if you increase trade under these conditions. And then, you know, there's some winners and losers, and they think maybe the steel workers get hit sometimes or the textile workers. But really, the statistics show, and these are undisputed, these are just from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau, nobody has any argument about this, is that it's everybody, not everybody, but the, you know, 70% of the labor force, which is everyone who doesn't have a college degree in the United States, has lost out as a result of this increased opening to trade and investment. And it's not the trade and investment per se, it's the way in which it's done. I mean, these agreements are written very deliberately to drive down the wages of the majority of our labor force. And again, this includes everybody up to, you know, at least 70% of the labor force that works for a living. So, and not just factory workers, because it affects wages throughout the economy. So that's the major effect of this. And, of course, part of the way it does this is because we lose manufacturing jobs, some of the better-paying jobs, and they're replaced with jobs like, you know, Starbucks and McDonald's and low-paid service sector jobs. But that's the jobs themselves are only one part of it. The wage effect is really much more massive, and this is really the most massive redistribution of income we've seen in U.S. economic history over the last 20 to 30 years, and a good part of it is due to these agreements.
I do want to ask you a question, sort of a follow-up question about job loss, since that is one of the things that is pointed to as a downside of NAFTA, and that some people make this argument that the number is something like at least a half a million, and some people say it's more over 800,000. I wonder what you think about those numbers, and, you know, maybe that's not that important, but I guess I would like to know what you think.
Well, that's a reasonable estimate, those numbers, I think the thing is, it's a little more complicated than that, because over a long period of time like that, the main determinant of employment is really the Federal Reserve. See, our central bank really controls unemployment most of the time by controlling the interest rates. So in other words, you know, throughout the last few decades, any period you want to take, when the Federal Reserve sees unemployment dropping too low, what they consider to be too low, they raise interest rates, and that slows down the economy because they, you know, people consume less. They, especially big ticket items like houses and cars and businesses, invest less, and so they do this very deliberately. It's not a conspiracy or anything. They believe that a certain level of unemployment is, if it's too low, if unemployment is too low, then that will cause inflation. So you see, and then that slows down the economy and increases the unemployment rate. And until the second half of the 90s, for example, Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve, followed a policy that said that 6% was as low as you could go. And then they got taken by surprise, and the unemployment rate fell below that. So you see, if you didn't have NAFTA eliminating these jobs, then the alternative scenario would have been that the Fed would have pursued higher interest rates and eliminated them in that way. And so it is, again, that's not to say that NAFTA doesn't matter, because particular industries get wiped out in a lot of areas of the country. You have enormous job loss that is a result directly of encouraging our corporations to making it easier and more profitable for them to leave the country. But the story is a little more complicated than it's usually presented, because our Federal Reserve really does control the unemployment rate in the United States most of the time.
I know that some people will make this argument that, you know, they will look at the question, was NAFTA good or bad, and they would say something like, well, that depends. It depends on who you are, where you live, what you do for a living. And they will say things like, oh, well, for example, if you look at agriculture here in the Midwest, we grow a lot of corn. An awful lot of that corn has gone to Mexico. So you'd say, well, maybe that's good for Midwestern corn farmers. Now, it hasn't been all that great for the Mexican corn farmers, because all this cheap corn has come in there and driven people off the land. So maybe you say, well, it's bad for them. On the other hand, people who grow produce on that side of the border, it's been good, because they've been able to send it into the United States. But then for people on this side, you know, say if you're growing Brussels sprouts, it's not been good, because you can't compete with lower priced product from Mexico. So it makes it look like it's harder to say, well, who exactly gains and loses. And aside from the, you know, the issue of that you pointed to, of decline in the quality of work that people have, it makes it seem a little bit more difficult to assess.
I don't think it's that difficult, because you can still look at what's happened to the majority of people, large numbers of people, and the economies on both sides of the border. Now, it's not going to affect our economy that much, because, first of all, we already had free trade with Mexico in goods and services before the agreement, right? Our average tariff on Mexican goods before the agreement was signed was 2.5%. So we didn't really have much to eliminate in terms of barriers. And so the effect is not that big of the agreement itself. Now, on the other hand, the Mexican corn farmers, yeah, there was a lot of, you know, in the millions probably got wiped out in terms of farmers in Mexico. Now, I'm glad you mentioned this, too, because you are in central Illinois, where I used to live. And, you know, there are some farmers who probably think, although not the ones that I talk to because they know better, but they probably think that it does help them to break into this market in Mexico. And in fact, it really doesn't, because you have to remember that the price of corn is determined on a world market, other than, you know, subsidies in the United States and things like that. But it's determined in a world market. And so if you open up the Mexican market to U.S. corn, it's not big enough to affect the price of corn. So in other words, any farmer in Illinois could, before NAFTA was signed, sell all the corn they wanted at the world market price. And they could do that after NAFTA as well. And the world market price was not changed by the demand for corn in Mexico. So you see, it wasn't big enough to benefit any corn farmers in Illinois or anywhere else in the United States.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Mark Weisbrot. He's currently the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. It is particularly interested in international economics, and we're talking here this morning about NAFTA. It's been 10 years since the passage of NAFTA, and we thought it would be a good idea at this point to do a little review of the effects of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And we plan here 2 hours of discussion in the first part of the show, a critical look, and the second, something that will be more supportive, I think, of NAFTA in the second part of the show. The guest is Dan Griswold. He is Associate Director of the Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian-oriented think tank in Washington, D.C. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller who would like to get in on the conversation here in Atlanta, Illinois, and that is line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Very interesting conversation here. The one thing I'm not particularly worried about is that we haven't been able, being on the poor side of things, being able to gain. It's the disparity between the rich and the poor. And one way that that's in the trade thing that's a little brought up that I've observed is that a lot of these goods that come into the United States that we could produce here that are produced in, you know, multiple other countries, when they come in here, they're priced at just a little bit below those same goods that they had been made in the United States, where due to the cost of labor, those goods don't nearly have the cost of labor that we would here because of obvious reasons. But that allows those people that are importers that are really doing nothing, maybe they do a little development, research and development on particular goods and move equipment over to other countries to build those goods. But those people get tremendously rich on those goods that come in here, and the average person like myself doesn't really get any benefit of the cheaper goods. We lose our resources like steel, like iron ore that goes to China to make steel. We lose resources stream out of this country. But we really don't get any bargains because even in clothing, sometimes an item from other country will be priced even a little bit more than the American-made item sometimes. But those people that are importing those make so much tremendous profit that, like grocery store chains, I know today, instead of advertising sales of food, they're advertising those other trinket goods that come in from these other countries. And I've never heard anybody discuss this, but I think it's kind of a crime that the importer, who really isn't contributing a whole lot, because, you know, small staff, that kind of thing, not much employment here, just makes tremendous profits compared to what goods here in the United States would do. And I think the bottom line is education. People need to understand that our money and our resources are just streaming out of this country in just unbelievable amounts, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, Mark, you want to respond to any of that?
Yes, I think the caller is right. I mean, obviously, there's still competition. There is international competition, and you do get cheaper consumer goods. And that's what the proponents, and I'm sure your guest, I've debated him before, Dan Griswold in the next hour, will point out you have cheaper consumer goods. But the thing he won't say is that when the numbers that I gave you, when I said that the median wage has gone almost nowhere in the United States, that's measuring over the last 30 years. That's measuring the real purchasing power. That's looking at what somebody can buy with their wages as compared to the 1980s, 70s, 60s, wherever far back you want to go. And you see, that's taking into account that these goods are cheaper. And even with the cheap DVD players that you can get, you know, for $100 now, you can get a DVD player. Even taking all of that into account, the wages of the majority of people in the United States have barely grown over a 30-year period as compared to growing, you know, very rapidly before that. So, you see, that means that the downward pressure on wages and salaries for the vast majority of our workers is so much greater than the gains that they get from the cheaper consumer goods. That's what that one number tells you when you look at the median wage or the wages for the whole, 50-60% of the workforce in the United States. That's what that is telling you. That that as a matter of just fact, whatever people got in the way of cheaper consumer goods did not compensate for the fact that their wages were thrown into competition with workers making a dollar or two an hour, and they were kept from rising in real terms, in terms of their real purchasing power. So that's what's really been going on. And the idea that this is a free trade, these are free trade agreements, of course, that's just a marketing term. You know, they're not really, the people promoting these agreements are government officials, the U.S. Trade Representative, the majority of the Congress. They're not really promoting free trade. They only want a competition, international competition, in goods and services that affect the majority of workers in the United States. They're not doing this to doctors, for example. You know, doctors in the United States get about twice as much as, they earn twice as much as doctors in Western Europe, other rich countries. they could do, if they wanted to, our government could do the same thing with doctor salaries. They could just simply let in a fairly small amount, maybe 60,000 people from other countries to practice medicine, and it would take a lot less effort than negotiating these kinds of agreements like NAFTA and the WTO. And you would push down the salaries of doctors to the level it is in other developed countries, and the savings to consumers would be, 20 times higher than all the savings we got from negotiating NAFTA or even the whole WTO. And yet they don't do that, and the reason is that the professionals, doctors, lawyers, accountants, they have enough clout politically to prevent that from happening to them. But the majority of people in the United States are so disenfranchised from our political system that the authorities are able to do that to them, to shift all the income away from them, to prevent them from sharing in the gains from economic growth over a period of decades, and then portray it through an advertising and marketing campaign as free trade. So it's very important that people understand that this isn't really about free trade. It's about driving down wages and salaries for the majority of the labor force and protecting others. And not just, I don't mean just the professional classes, but, look at the pharmaceutical companies, for example. One of the things they put into NAFTA was protection for them, the intellectual property chapter. So you had, this is a form of protectionism. From an economic point of view, this is exactly the same thing that is that economists are against when they talk about tariffs or quotas or barriers to trade. Well, a patent is economically the exact same thing as any other trade restriction. And in fact, that's why you see people going out and trying to practice free trade on the Canadian border, the Mexican border, where they're trying to get their pharmaceuticals whenever they can. Because the free trade in medicines is something that really would save people money. But this is protected by NAFTA and in the WTO and all the other agreements. So there's enormous protectionism where it's most costly and where it's, most expensive from an economic point of view. But there's ruthless free trade and international competition when it comes to the wages and salaries of most of the people in the United States.
Well, let's talk with some others. Let's go next to a caller here in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was intending to bring something up, and it seems like your guest has actually brought it up, but I'm going to sort of go in another direction. You said intellectual property. One of the items that I was going to talk about was, or ask you to talk about, was the fact that there's all this, call it counterfeiting, call it theft of intellectual property by our trading partners, which is creating major economic problems for the United States. You brought up the pharmaceutical industry. You could talk about that. You could talk about computer industry, software, entertainment industry, music, video. This is a major problem, which China, of course, is the most egregious, but south of the border, we have lots of other problems with that as well. And I also, if I could then shift to another problem, which you touched upon but really didn't go into, is outsourcing. This outsourcing of not factory jobs, but outsourcing of technical skills, jobs that require high education, whether in terms of computer programming or accounting work. This seems to be a major problem for the United States, and I'd like to hear you talk about it and talk about what we could do about it, because I think both of those have economic consequences for all of us and pose a potential danger that is enormous to our economy and to the way of life. Okay, I'll hang up and and hear from you.
All right.
Thank you.
Yes, well, this is two big subjects, so I'll try to give them reasonably short answers, but they're very relevant because, as I said, one of the major purposes of these agreements is to protect intellectual property. and it's enormously costly thing for consumers in developing countries, but also in the United States. I think the best answer to the problem of intellectual property that we have is that it really is an outmoded system from hundreds of years ago, and it's becoming increasingly inefficient. In other words, you know, the purpose in our Constitution and in our law, the purpose of a patent monopoly, for example, is to provide funding to the owner of the monopoly so that you can fund research and development. Now, in pharmaceuticals, for example, in the biomedical research area, we already have the majority of biomedical research is funded by the government and nonprofit sector, you know, the National Institutes of Health, the universities and foundations. So you see, that's already half of that is already in the public sector. Now, the thing is, the patent system is extremely wasteful for the same reason that, you know, high levels of protectionism are inefficient. It's the exact same thing. So you have a drug, you know, that costs maybe, you know, $100 a year to produce, and it sells for $8,000, like the antiretroviral drugs that are used to treat HIV infection and AIDS, for example. And this became a major issue, of course, because, you know, still is today, because you have tens of millions of people in developing countries who cannot get these life-saving medicines because that are produced in India for a couple hundred dollars a year, and they're cost $8,000 in the United States because of this patent protection. So this is the extreme case where it's really it's enormously costly and horrible in terms of its effect on human life. But it cuts across the whole spectrum of patent-protected medicine. That it really is terribly wasteful to have these patent monopolies. And in fact, we have a paper. Anybody can find any of this stuff on our website. It's www.cepr.net. We have a paper showing that in the United States alone, the savings from just funding the rest of our biomedical research or pharmaceutical research through the public sector, if we just did that, it would more than pay for itself just from the savings to the government in Medicare and Medicaid, not including all the other savings to consumers and to the rest of the world. So I think we're fighting a losing battle, just like the recording companies, I think, are fighting a losing battle when they try and scare people into not downloading music over the Internet. These are, you know, the technology has passed up the legal relationships that were based on relationships 100 years ago, and the inefficiencies have increased to the point where they're not going to be viable. And the sooner we recognize that, the sooner we can talk about funding for research and development and creative activity in ways that that make sense from an economic point of view, not just from the point of view of a handful of companies. Now, the outsourcing question is a good one, and that's been going on, of course, for decades, and the only difference is now it's information and technology jobs, software, some of the computer jobs that used to be in the United States are now being moved at a more rapid pace overseas to countries like India and China, and that's increasing at a very rapid rate. And I think what's happening here is just is that now it's becoming more of an issue because you have more, you know, higher paid sectors of the labor force are being affected by it, whereas before it was, as I said, the 70% of workers without a college degree that were most being impacted by this particular form of globalization that was designed to push down their wages and salaries. Now it's happening at the higher end with technical professionals. And I think that's part of the reason why it's getting more and more difficult for Congress to continue passing these kinds of agreements.
Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, or in fact, if you would happen to be listening over the Internet, you can use the toll-free line as long as you're in the United States. That's 800-222-9455 and then 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We're a little bit past the midpoint. I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Mark Weisbrot. He is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., has Ph.D. in economics from University of Michigan with specialization in international economics and political economy. He's author of a weekly column on economic and policy issues distributed to over 400 papers across the country. His opinion pieces have appeared in many different publications, including the Washington Post, the LA Times, Boston Globe. He has also appeared, has been interviewed and taken part in discussions of this issue and other related issues on radio, on television. Questions, again, are welcome if you'd like to give us a call. I think we are getting some other folks here lined up. In fact, we're all ready to go. Next, we'll go to a caller in Urbana on line number one. Hello.
Yeah, you mentioned that you didn't think that NAFTA had much of an effect on the exportation of corn from Illinois. Well, I'd refer people to an article by Tina Rosenberg, New York Times, back in August, called "The Free Trade Fix," where she kind of analyzes that whole thing and talks about it in terms of what agricultural officials in Mexico saw after NAFTA, and your characterization is saying that the world price, that those are all before tariffs, as I understand, and other trade barriers. And it's and I think it's quite clear that NAFTA caused because our subsidized agriculture had very destructive effect on Mexican agriculture. But I don't really want to argue that because you've got a lot more facts at your disposal than I do. I do want to ask you this, though. When it comes to trying to analyze NAFTA and the effect of NAFTA, and I'm particularly interested in Mexico, U.S. Effects, how do you figure in the devaluation of the peso in, I believe it was 1994? How does that... Didn't that confuse the whole thing? And number two, to what extent were there sort of fundamentals behind that devaluation? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I'll respond to both points. I mean, I didn't, I think a caller misinterpreted what I said. I didn't say that the effect on Mexico was small of U.S. corn entering as a result of NAFTA. It was quite devastating to Mexican agriculture, and so we agree completely on that. What I did say was that it didn't make much difference for Illinois corn farmers to be able to get their corn into Mexico because they're already selling as much corn as they can produce at the world market price, and so the Mexican market was not big enough to affect the price, as to raise the price that they received, and therefore they had no net benefit from being able to export to Mexico, whereas they didn't export as much corn to Mexico before NAFTA. So it's one of those situations where you had a big loss to millions of Mexican farmers, but you did not have a corresponding gain to the farmers in Illinois or anywhere else in the United States that exported the corn. Now, in terms of the devaluation of the peso at the end of 94 and beginning of 95, that's when it affected the economy. That was, of course, it was partly a result of policies that were very deliberate. They kept the peso overvalued, and part of the reason they did that was because the United States, of course, was trying to pass NAFTA, right, in 93. And so they wanted to keep the U.S. trade surplus, which we had at the time with Mexico, and they knew that the, at least we knew, that the peso was going to fall and that Mexico would therefore increase its exports to the United States and reduce its imports, but they wanted to delay that as long as they could in order to pass NAFTA through the U.S. Congress. You have to remember, Clinton had to fight very hard for that. He couldn't get a majority of his own party to vote for it, even at the end. So that was, I think, that policy was driven by U.S. politics, the overvalued, keeping the peso overvalued for that time. And I should say, by the way, because I'm thinking of David's question, well, how do you measure the impact on these countries? One way you can look at the impact on Mexico is to just look at the growth rate, right? That's the most important measure of economic success. Even though it doesn't tell you anything about how anything is distributed, if the economy doesn't grow, you don't have anything to distribute. And from a purely economic point of view, if the economy doesn't grow, you have a failure. And if you look at the 10 years since NAFTA, the Mexican economy has grown pretty badly. It's grown about less than 1% each year in terms of income per person, which is the most basic measure that economists have. So any economist that calls that a success, I think, is really not being honest. That's just the straight numbers. And, you know, just to give you an example, I mean, you know, prior to this experiment, this economic experiment that I described that began in the 80s in Mexico, Mexico was a fast-growing country. You had incomes that grew, income per person from 1960 to 1979 grew by 93%. In other words, it practically doubled. And it's grown very little since then. So these policies have been a failure for Mexico even more than for the United States.
All right, let's go to another call here, Danville. That will be line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I have a couple comments. It was very interesting, your remark about the foreign doctors. The United States government is one of the worst offenders of that. If you'll check with any of their VA hospitals, you'll find that they have thousands of foreign doctors indentured who, after finishing their time, go on to the communities around them. But my other comment is about the spinoff from NAFTA, that these corporations setting up their headquarters offshore and that to get out of the paying of the taxes, which is also pretty hard on the economy here. I'll listen.
All right. Well, Mark?
No, that's right. That's been another side effect of these agreements, is that corporations have been encouraged again to move production overseas. And as they do so, they get more and more tax breaks where they don't have to pay taxes to the U.S. government. And, you know, our corporate, the share of income, the share of taxes that is paid by corporations in the United States is lower than it's ever been for at least 50 years, probably by now. We have to go back to the 1950s. So, or before, it's probably lower the whole post-World War II period. So that's another result of these kinds of agreements.
Next is Charleston, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, I've listened with interest, and I think thus far the discussion has been about the symptoms of what has been occurring over the last 20 or so years. And I wonder if your guest might have some observation on how we can change things.
Sure. Well, I think the first thing, I'm glad to see you can pick up WLL in Charleston now. When I lived there, I couldn't do that. But I think in terms of changing, the first thing, when you have a train that's going in the wrong direction, the first thing you have to do is stop it, and then you can try turning it around. And so I think the first thing we have to do is stop them from spreading these agreements that have failed to more and more countries, to the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which is going to come up in Congress pretty soon. The free trade area of the Americas, which is another plan that the Bush administration has for, 34 countries in the Americas, based on NAFTA. So when, their idea is that failure is impossible from their point of view, it benefits certain interests, and those are the most powerful interests in our country, in the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable. And so they're pushing ahead with these agreements, and they're trying to just do more of the same. And I think the first thing we have to do, they're running into a lot more resistance than they ever had from countries like Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela, for instance, in South America. And so now we have a chance to stop them, and to and then we can begin to, after we've done that, we can start to think about what reasonable trade and commercial policies would look like.
We have now less than 15 minutes left, maybe 12, 13 minutes left, and I want to know that the guest in this first hour, Focus 580, Mark Weisbrot, he's an economist, he's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about NAFTA. I also want to make sure that people know that in the second hour, we'll have more discussion, but from a different perspective, a different point of view, with someone who is much more supportive of NAFTA and its effects. Dan Griswold will be the guest. He is associate director of the Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and I know that he and Mark Weisbrot have debated each other more than once on these very issues. So again, an opportunity to hear a different point of view and also ask questions, make comments. We do, of course, here have time for other callers, and the number, if you're in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Then, if you're on the fringes of the area, or at least not an immediate area here, and it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And we do have someone on that line, a listener in Indiana, line number 4. Hello?
Yeah, since you've debated the fellow coming up, that I didn't know, but I was going to ask you the same question. Could you give some of the views of the fellow that's coming up and give your views of why he's wrong? I'm on your side, but I know a lot of people I talk to always bring up what they presume are facts about how it has helped certain groups. And I'm not just talking about, the upper echelon, but other people. But I'd wonder if you could more or less do a debate without the other partner there for a couple of minutes.
Sure. It's actually not that hard because I can tell you what he's going to say. First, he's going to say that, he's going to argue, make the textbook theory that you see in your Econ 101 courses, that there's free trade is good for everyone. It benefits everyone. It's a win-win situation because every country specializes in what they're more efficient at. And as a result, you get gain to the consumers. What he won't tell you, of course, is that the gains to the consumers in the United States have been more than outweighed by the downward pressure on wages. And again, you can see this by just looking what's happened to the median wage in the United States over the past 25 or 30 years. The other argument he's going to make is that it's good for Mexico and for developing countries. And again, he won't give you the growth statistics for Mexico over the last 10 years or 20 years, any period you want to compare it to, as compared with what Mexico used to grow before they started to pursue these policies that were promoted by Washington. So I think those are going to be his two main arguments, that we all benefit from the cheaper consumer goods, and that free trade is efficient and it promotes growth. He's going to argue that countries that practice free trade grow faster. And actually, there is a literature that tries to show this. It's mainly research by the World Bank that says that countries that open up more grow faster. And the problem, of course, with this literature, this economics, is that it doesn't show causality. So in other words, it doesn't show what causes what. So in other words, if you start to grow faster, you're going to import more. And so countries that grow fast end up with a larger share of trade in their economy, like China, for example. And that doesn't mean that they practice free trade or that the free trade led to the growth. It's usually the other way around. The economy grows faster, and then they open up to more trade. So the most compelling argument, again, is what has happened to income in the United States? What's happened to the distribution of income? How have the majority of people in the United States lost out Really, this is all the standard economic research shows. There's no debate that the majority of the labor force has lost out over the last 30 years, and their income has gone to people, you know, mainly rich people. And that's just a fact that he won't deny. And the question is, how much of that is a result of trade? And any economist that's looked at it will admit that some significant part of it is due to trade, and the only debate is over how much.
All right, let's go to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi, hello. Maybe a little more theoretical question. As I understand it, an economy is basically made up of producers, capital, goods and services, labor, and consumers. And it seems to me that there's a fundamental problem in instituting a free universal economic system if you only allow basically producers, capital, and goods and services to move freely, but you don't allow consumers and labor to move freely. And as an example, I would say a free trade area which seems to be fairly successful is that of Western Europe, the European Community. And in the European Community, basically, they do have free movement of labor and of goods and services and capital and even now a common currency and to the extent necessary, consumers can also move. Do you have any comment?
Well, yes, I think the European model of integration is much better than ours, although it's been terribly flawed in recent years in terms of their macroeconomic policy. Their interest rate policy and their budget policy has been way too restrictive, and as a result, you have much higher unemployment than in Europe than you have here, and you know the economies have suffered from that. But you're right about the at least the earlier stages of integration. Well, first of all, you're dealing with countries that were closer to the same level of development, so you can integrate. It's easier to integrate. And when they did do the integration, they did put at least some tens of billions of dollars into when they decided to, you know, form the European Community. They put money into lifting up the poorer countries. You know, Portugal, Greece, the Ireland got benefits from the richer countries, so as to try at least to make an attempt to integrate these economies in a way that pulled people up, rather than trying to create a race to the bottom that would push the wages, for example, of the richer countries down to the level of the poorer countries. And what we have in the NAFTA is the exact opposite. It's deliberately designed, and CAFTA and the FTAA, it's deliberately designed to push our wages and salaries down towards the level of the poorer partners, which in this case is Mexico so far.
Yeah, I agree completely, and I think that this our approach, the U.S. approach to sort of global economic integration is just terribly dislocating because it leaves out, for example, free movement of labor, which is something that probably we wouldn't want until a place like Mexico's economy was already approaching the level of our own.
Yes, I think that's right. You can't have completely free movement of labor between economies that have such a vast disparity of income.
Right.
All right. Thank you. We'll try to get one more caller in here in Urbana, line two.
Yeah, I called earlier. I just have a quick question. I really liked what you said about the median wage, and I was just curious. Does that include, does it put in a zero figure for those people who are unemployed? And B, can we expect the follow-up speaker to in the next hour to attack your concept of the median wage, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
No, first of all, you know, I'm just first of all, the first part of the question was does that include people who are unemployed? It actually doesn't. So it's just looking at employed labor. The second part, you know, I'm just remembering the last debate that I did have with Dan, and I actually used one of his charts because he used the same figures. He showed what has happened to wages in the United States. And so there's no real debate over the numbers here. It's just a question of how you spin them. I think what he would say is that, you know, during the 90s, for example, you know, the second half of the 90s, you did have some wage growth in the United States. And it is true. It wasn't great, but it was better than what you had before, which was either zero or negative for, you know, for many years for the median wage. And it is true. When the Federal Reserve allows our unemployment rate to get down to less than 4%, as we did in the second half of the 90s, you will see some wage growth. But if you take, that's why you have to take a long period, and that's why we look at longer periods in order to assess the impact of these policies, because the economy is always going through business cycles, right? And so if I were to just look at the last year, there's been almost no wage growth at all in the United States. And so that's, you know, that's because we're not in a recession, but we're in a very weak labor market right now. But that's why when you take a 29-year period and there's been very, very little growth in the median wage, that shows you a long-term structural problem. That something has gone terribly wrong when the vast majority of the labor force does not share in the gains from growth. And, you know, anybody who was around, I mean, some of your callers sound old enough to remember, you know, the 50s, the 60s, or even the 70s, you can remember that it was not uncommon for somebody who was, you know, just the average level of wages, an ordinary worker, to buy a house with one income and raise a family and send their kids to college, and that doesn't happen anymore.
We're going. I'm sorry to jump in on there, Mark. We're just going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time.
Sure.
We'll have more discussion. Obviously, same issues, different perspective in the next hour. For the moment, we want to say thanks to our guest, Mark Weisbrot, from the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. If you have internet access, you're interested in learning more about him and his organization, you can go to the website, www.ceper.net. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, David.